Hello, everyone, and welcome to History in Technicolor. Wolf, I have an apology to make.
What's the apology, David?
Apology is that I introduce every episode.
Yes.
I mean, and I'd like to formally apologise and hand the introduction to this episode over to you, Wolf.
Hello, welcome to a History in Technicolor. I am Wolf, and this is David.
David, whenever I introduce it, I allow you to say Wolf.
Well, I was... went mad with power and felt compelled to speak on behalf of both of us.
Mad with power.
Just put me back in my place, David.
So, what are we doing today?
David, you are doing The Last Emperor.
Excellent. Thank you for your kind introduction, Wolf. I'm going to do The Last Emperor, and I know what you're going to ask me. You're going to ask me, why am I doing that? I'm doing it for a few reasons. First of all, I'm doing it because of an image. The image I have in my head is of a tiny boy dressed up to the nines, pushing against a yellow sheet, which has stayed, and this image has stayed in my mind as the last emperor and what it was all about, so the vibrant colours and this kind of mystic sense. Secondly, because it's good to step outside, a little bit outside what we know. We've been doing a lot of English history, a lot of European history. Well, you know, let's go to another country, so I thought that'd be good. Because it felt too early to do our Alamo double bill, which we had planned on the Facebook site. And so I panicked a little bit, honestly. Honestly, I panicked. Then I saw how long it was. And I wondered maybe the reason I chose this movie was because I hate myself.
And me.
And you. Just a little bit. It's 2 hours, 43 minutes long. Although I bring you tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people.
There's a longer version, isn't
there? There's a longer version at 3 hours, 3 hours, 39 minutes.
Isn't this film almost exactly the same length, though, as A Bridge Too Far?
Yes.
Isn't that 230 yeah. something?
We should rename both films An Hour Too Far, shouldn't we?
Yep.
What a great gag that was.
I'm still laughing.
Yeah, excellent. So, The Last Emperor won 9 Oscars, including the big ones, Best Picture, Best Director. You know, absolutely loved at the time. I've forgotten when it was produced. Was it 87?
I think it's 87.
87. It was directed by Bernardo Bertolucci, who I thought was Silvio Berlusconi.
In many ways, they are the same person.
No, come on. One's a media magnate and one's a media. Hey, are they the same person?
All I'm saying is they both have a reputation, should I say.
They have a reputation. So Bertolucci, I've loved doing this programme with you, Wolf, because I get to read about stuff I've never read about else. So The Conformist in 1970, The Last Tango in Paris 1972, apparently very controversial. Accusation from the actress Maria Schneider that she was effectively raped on screen, that she felt like that.
Bertolucci's a bit of a scumbag.
Bertolucci's a bit of a scumbag.
I think we have to be honest.
Okay.
As soon as you search him up, there's just endless articles about the insensitive comments he makes. He does a bit of a Roman Polanski where he likes to take any opportunity to step out of the woodwork. And for example, I'm pretty sure Bertolucci said recently, considering everything that's happening, he said Ridley Scott was wrong to take Kevin Spacey out of all the money in the world due to his abuse scandal.
Right.
And as such, Bertolucci welcomes and actively wants to work with Kevin Spacey at the next possible opportunity.
Right.
And that really just feels like a person
kind of,
who is...
He likes pouring oil on the fire rather than...
Yeah, and he really will do anything to kind of oppose stuff like the Me Too movement, etc. And regardless of his views, he wants to do it in the public eye because he's scandalous.
So there we go. So we've got an idea of Bertolucci, where he comes from. And he's also very politically very left-wing, apparently, 1900, which he did in 1976.
Which actually sounds fascinating.
Right. It did sound quite interesting, actually. So, okay, so that's some of the background about him. The film is based on a man called Puyi. Puyi is... Who's Puyi?
He's the last emperor.
Yeah, I'm just checking you've basically done your research, okay? Puyi is the last emperor. It's based on his own autobiography, which is supposed to have been reasonably open, actually, from what I can see. I haven't read it, but I've seen quotes, etc. And a book also written by his Scottish tutor, Reginald Johnson. The film tells the story of... What does it tell the story of?
The Last Emperor.
The Last Emperor, fantastic. The clue is in the movie. The Last Emperor of China. So it goes through, you know, obviously a fascinating period of China's history, all the way through from his birth in 1908, through the creation of Republican China in 1912, through the war and all the civil wars, even through the Cultural Revolution in 1967. So it's a fascinating period in Chinese history, and you get a kind of view on it. So it's about the last emperor. What's it really about? In the way, Wolf, that Jaws is not about a shark, what is it about?
So on the spur of the moment, I would say, and I'm not 100% certain on this, that it's really about the loss of culture and identity of a civilization, and specifically their figurehead, potentially how that is affected by and maybe even destroyed by the West.
Interesting. That's a very interesting discussion, because I kind of rather doubt Bertolucci would make a film like that, but I could be wrong. But maybe he would. Maybe he would, given his left-wing.
It's clearly about the struggles of the individual who happens to have been the emperor, and how he struggles to deal with his role and his deteriorating importance. And later on in the movie, he does lots of little acts to make himself more important.
But isn't there something about acceptance along the way?
And there is. So it's his individual journey.
Yeah.
But you open the movie in the Forbidden City and you end the movie with tourists entering the Forbidden City. Essentially, it's a haunting, terrible scene.
Yeah.
You feel so... it's weird as it sounds. It almost feels like the place has been violated by the presence of all of these people.
How interesting. I didn't,
did you not?
I didn't feel like that.
Did it not shock you?
We're going to the end. We're going
I just want to say, because that is the opening and the end of the movie. And that's
it
a nice little brandy. Did it not shocking? Because it covers the time period as well.
Yeah.
So you go from 1908, when it's a locked off city and no one can go in or out really. And it ends with the tour guides beeping their horns, waving their flags, leading crowds and crowds of people.
It feels very nostalgic. But it also feels, in the way that he acts in that final scene, it also feels as though it's about acceptance of his own personal journey through life and to some sort of peace. So for me, the film is about acceptance of your place in the universe. I doubt Bertolucci thought it was about that either. So either of us could be
right.
And
obviously, because he has communist leanings, it is interesting that he's making a film where they transition into a communist rule.
Indeed.
How critical is he really of their system?
Very interesting point, yeah.
That is to be worth considering. I just think, as we move through it, the influence of the West through Peter O'Toole's character, so England and Scotland, and America through the 1920s, 30s, Great Gatsby-style parties that are going on, that really, by this point, the loss of identity and the loss of... for the country... has been so dramatic, and it's hard not to see the influence of these other countries coming and getting involved.
Okay, so we've got two different views, and maybe it's about both things. One of the thing the film did for me was reaffirm my personal belief that the answer to a happy life is what, Wolf? In two words. You've got two words. Answer to a happy life.
Crickets?
Possibly. Low. That's only one word, by the way. Low expectations.
Oh, low expectations. Okay.
The answer to a happy life is
I thought there was something that happened in the movie that was like your...
Well, this
key.
Is the point. That he has, in the end, the movie takes us all the way through his life and his search for some meaning and some control.
So you think he's happy when he has nothing?
In the end, he's happiest when he has nothing and he is a gardener,
yes,
which is where he ends. So for me, that was something the... I expected to be remorselessly bored with the movie. When I saw the length, I thought, this is a nightmare. And it seemed obvious to me that it was going to be about form over substance. It was going to be about the colours, the sumptuous sets, the environment, rather than... real substance about a character and characters. So I was maybe a little bit jaundiced. And I sat down with a sense of heavy gloom. And yet I was not bored. It dragged me in, actually, almost against myself. Having said that, talking about the quality of the movie now, the most amazing thing about the film are the set, the colours, the music. It is an orgy of the senses. It is an absolute orgy. And you're talking to a man who, when I go to St. Peter's in Rome or the Vatican, when I go to St. Mark's in Venice, the only thing I want are two things, a sick bag and a bucket of whitewash. I'm not a man for colour, okay? And yet this film was
I thought you were going to say gelato.
Oh, gelato would also be very nice, yeah. But whitewash mainly. So I'm not really a man for colour, and yet this is sumptuous, you know. It's amazing colours, incredible sets that actually drew me in despite my basic Presbyterian, even though I'm not Presbyterian, you know, whatever, let's not get into religion. Anyway, it starts amazingly, you know, it starts with him trying to commit suicide and the blood of his veins seeping into the water, and then you get this red filtered scene with this dowager duchess, this empress who makes him king. So that is amazing. And actually, what you get to see is this sort of roll of history through his eyes. And that is interesting and drags you in. The film has its problems. Sorry, say you want
I
to
I just
say
want
something?
To ask you a question.
Sorry, did I give you permission to talk?
I'm in charge of this episode, okay, David. We established
right.
this
Sorry.
When I did the introduction.
We did. You're so right.
Even if you just think about this and you come back to me on this later, did you learn anything significant about the history of this some 60-year time period from this film?
Yes, I did. And let's talk about that in historical accuracy.
Okay.
But yes, I did. Absolutely.
You genuinely did?
I did. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The film has its problems. Mainly for me, doesn't really have a likeable character in it. It has some characters you feel sympathetic for. You feel sympathetic for Wanzu, the consort. A little bit. And you feel sympathetic, I think, for Wan Ron, his wife, the Empress. You don't feel... I didn't personally feel sympathetic for him. He's a rather empty, shallow young man, self-absorbed, cruel to everybody around him. I mean, it would have been amazing had he been anything else, given his upbringing, alone in the Forbidden City, without really any effective control or power outside that small enclosed world, which it describes amazingly. Nonetheless, it's difficult to feel much sympathy for him because he is such a cruel character.
Is it somewhat frustrating that Peter O'Toole spends so much time with him and yet he's still this selfish man?
Yes, and how could you spend time with Peter O'Toole and end up being selfish? Yeah?
He seems to almost get worse with the more tutoring that he has.
He does, yeah, it's true. And yet, as you say, Reginald Johnson is painted as a warm, humanist-type character with a wide range of education, and yet he's utterly self-absorbed. But again, you know, didn't have much chance, did he? There he was on his own with all these sycophants and eunuchs around him to do his every command and bidding and kept in this, trapped in this tiny world.
He doesn't really begin to appreciate his place in the world until it is forced upon him by the communist regime.
Indeed. Yeah. The emptiness of his life is forever with you through the film and, you know, beautifully described. If that's the objective of the film, you really feel that. But it is not a film that engages you emotionally in the way that, say, The Full Monty does.
No. No, not at all. It's definitely visual, like, the whole way through.
Yeah.
And I would perhaps even argue that style does come over substance.
Right.
Perhaps more than you
More than
feel.
I'm now saying, yeah.
But, yeah, you're kind of continued to be pulled through this world by the wonderful images and the colours. And then obviously they contrast that with the starkness of the kind of the modern scenes which are taking place in the 50s in the prison.
So did you enjoy it as a film before we move on to the history bit?
It's unbelievably long. It really is. I thought I'd done 3.5 hours. So when you tell me it's 2:40, I kind of can't believe what's happened. It felt like it went on for forever.
Right. That suggests you didn't really enjoy it that much.
I never really connected with it.
Mm.
So I could tell that it was visually impressive. And I could tell that the history was fascinating. And I didn't know much about it. So the way I talk about the film since then means that it's had an impact. Because I'm excited, I'm engaged, I'm interested. I've wanted to look up and learn more about it. But maybe because my attention was drifting. But I don't really feel like I truly learned how China transitioned. I know it's not maybe the purpose of the film, but I don't really understand what happened for them to lose the emperor, for China to transition through these stages, and then to end up in this place where the kind of communist regime has taken over.
Yeah, that's
over.
Quite interesting, isn't it? Unlike the film we reviewed 2 weeks ago, A Bridge Too Far, which very clearly sets out to lay all the facts in front of you, this is always a partial view through the eyes of the emperor, isn't it? And therefore, you see these events that he would have understood more. But maybe that's perfect.
He's protected slightly from the information. Yes. He has to ask people, and then they tell him, oh, yes, you actually aren't the emperor.
Yeah.
But we didn't really want to tell you. But even later on when he's left, I'm still... And maybe I just missed it because I was losing some will to live. But I'm slightly confused as to Japan's involvement and somewhat confused by the creation of the new state in Manchuria and then his taking over it. And it's... Well,
Japan basically invades and sets up a puppet state in Manchuria. And it just so happens that you have two dynasties in China historically. We have more than two, but two of the dynasties are the Qing, who are represented by the last emperor, and they've been ruling for several hundred years. But they are actually foreigners, in a sense. They are from Manchuria, they are from the north, whereas the Ming, considered local, are... Anyway, this is not turning to a history lesson. The point is, I absolutely agree that it's a very partial view. You see kind of what he sees and what is explained to him, and it's about him rather than the history.
Yes.
And therefore, in a way, that's a very good approach, because I would argue, because you're really interested. I am the same as you. I was really interested by all these events and wanted to know more. And therefore, it led me to go and find more. And I bought a biography of Mao Zedong and all the rest of it, because I wanted to know more. Isn't that, in a sense, the perfect thing?
Yes, I will accept that.
But it's very partial.
So from an entertainment point of view, I did think it was relatively entertaining. I could understand probably if in a cinema, perhaps I'd be caught up in it a little bit more. Peter O'Toole was really good. A lot of the performances were really great. I was definitely intrigued and kind of bought in by it all. But they're just little things. Maybe it's having some knowledge of Bertolucci, but the amount that he fetishizes things is frustrating. Even from early on, the eroticism of the wet nurse is irritating.
Right.
There's no need for her to have exposed breasts randomly when she's just delivering dialogue and there's no one around. And I can't help but feel that this old, dirty Italian man...
Right.
That's not an insult. It's just that's just how I think... that's just what I think of
it's
him.
It's just a factual description.
That he's doing these things just to kind of... it's his most mainstream film that he's ever made.
Right.
But I feel that these are trends just in his work and his kind of approach to life. And he slightly over-sexualizes things that don't need to be.
Right. And well, there is one very famous scene, isn't there, where we have this kind of rather Matahari Japanese spy figure. And there is a lesbian scene with her and the Empress, the wife, Puyi's wife, which apparently never happened.
And the fact that... And then with her... smoking opium at the time, like in the whole scene, it doesn't really have much historical accuracy, the whole thing, and it doesn't fit into the plot or the story. And in a 2-hour 43 movie or a 3.5-hour movie, if you watch
the opiate stuff does.
Yes,
that fits in, and it fits into her character progression. You know, from her feeling of uselessness of her life, but with all this false wealth around her given by the Japanese. But the lesbian bit means nothing.
No, and giving us these scenes, I know they're not all the time, it's a small amount, but there is generally this like eroticism of all of the women. And considering that he in real life was mostly uninterested in women and sexual encounters as well, it seems an odd fact.
Yeah, it's not odd, is it? I mean, it's perfectly and you know, nakedly obvious that what he is doing is trying to titillate the audience.
Yeah,
that Puyi historically appears to have had no interest in women, may have been gay, but even that's not clear at all. He just seems to be rather asexual, and yet you have this ménage à trois at the beginning, and you have this lesbian sex scene. You know, Bertolucci just put that in to try and keep keep people interested.
And what's annoying is the history is so good and the story is so fascinating that we're going to be interested anyway.
Yeah.
He's then made this visually stunning movie which has already got like us completely captivated. So when he's giving us these scenes, I find it somewhat offensive as a viewer because I know that it's not required.
Yeah.
And I know that it's being done for reasons that I don't agree with.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that should be presented.
Yeah.
And it adds into this greater overall kind of exoticism of the East. And these scenes are all used to kind of make them fantastical. And it's this kind of this desire to take us on this kind of sensual experience that we might not have an idea for. And it kind of wants to create this fantasy about this place so that Western audiences can lose themselves in it as if they were like going to an opium den or whatever.
Right. So do you think it panders to a Western view of the East, as it were?
Yeah, I think so. When there are scenes that don't have any historical accuracy and don't have any real benefit to the plot in any sense, when they're being added, they're just to kind of further this image, this kind of cinematic tourism of this kind of civilization that we can only like dream of and is so unusual to us. And I find it just slightly... things grate on me throughout this movie. And I'm really also unsure about Reginald Johnson's role.
Yeah.
And his character, he's quite reserved, and I feel like his opinions are hidden a little bit. And it's for him to return to England, leave all of the trouble behind, then be very successful at Cambridge, or was it Oxford?
I can't remember.
And then write this book, Twilight in the Forbidden City. And then, I don't know, he just benefits a lot from this.
Yeah. So I absolutely agree that there is definitely part of this which is the East seen through Western eyes. You know, I agree with your comment.
And I had a problem with that coming into the film.
Yeah.
I'm aware that I'm going to watch a film about the last emperor of China made by an Italian man.
Mm.
Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have that kind of ability to make these stories from all around the world, but I would be far more interested if this was made by Chinese filmmakers.
So I'm not necessarily going to agree with you, because I might say that if a Western, it's quite an interesting debate actually, so a Western filmmaker could genuinely present this, do the research, get the actors, get the historical support and all the rest of it that allowed you to see things through a genuinely a Chinese perspective, that would be a double triumph. Because then that filmmaker could also understand how his audience is going to be made to be interested in it, and that would be a double benefit. In this, I agree that he is, to a degree, pandering to the Western lens of what they think the East is about. So I agree he doesn't consciously try and break that barrier. No,
it's not the worst, but he definitely leans into like exoticizing everything and kind of padding this film out with all of this extra detail that he wants to put in himself, a lot of it, some of it isn't historically accurate. Yeah. Bearing in mind we kind of have the autobiography and it's not that long ago. Yeah. We have all these accounts. He still kind of twists a few things, and it seems really ultimately to make China seem unusual to us in all forms of its government and rule and all of its traditions and all the people are meant to, and really the only one character who seems sensible, rational, logical is the Englishman.
Although I don't agree with that, actually. So the prison governor, for example, is shown as a very humane man, and that's one of the other questions, actually.
Then he's punished.
But that's really interesting, because this, one of the big questions is, this is officially approved and access given for the first time to the Forbidden City by the Chinese authorities. So the obvious question you ask is, well, how has that affected the way the movie is made? And actually, it isn't bad. Now, I would have said that the punches are pulled, and there was a very cross article, American article I read, that's saying, oh, you know, and there's no doubt that punches are pulled in the way these prisoners are treated. Nonetheless, that man, the prison governor, is presented as a humane man, and Pu Yi goes through the prison system and comes out the other end.
Yes.
And he's the last emperor of China. You've got to think many regimes, Tudor England, would have chopped his head off within seconds.
Yes.
So that's certainly not an act of propaganda. And there are other characters in the movies who are presented as sensible, humane as well as Reginald Johnson.
I know, but do you not think that the ruler of the prison essentially still suffers from being in China?
Yes, he does.
And do you not think that Reginald Johnson sees that things are getting bad and he doesn't like the way that the future's going to look, and then he's like, well, I better go back to...
I don't know that it's presented that way. I mean, I do agree with you that there is something very obviously about sort of the lodestone is this Western person. I would argue there are other lodestones, even if they end up being badly treated by the system. Nonetheless, if you evaluate as a person, you think the prison governor, that is a, you know, that is a kind of hero.
When you get towards the middle of the movie, and he's moved to Japan and Manchuria.
Yeah.
And it's in, what, the 30s? And they're all having these F. Scott Fitzgerald type events. How do you feel about seeing these characters now kind of on the run, wearing American clothes, participating in these American parties?
To be honest, that felt fine to me because that is what it was like.
Yes.
And I think what the film does accurately portray is that cultural imperialism of the West, view it as you wish. In Japan, they were wanting to take on many aspects about Western culture and Western technology in particular. The same was happening in China. I think that was pretty accurately presented. You know, we're talking about the details of the lesbian sex scene, for example, and those were clearly wrong, but the basic story is pretty accurate.
But do you feel that the kind of... Because I want to... This is interesting to me. Do you feel that the movie is just portraying it, or do you think the movie is kind of suggesting that the influence of the West leads to more issues in their relationship, leads to opium addiction, leads to...
Yeah.
These kind of experiences of excess, the drinking, all of this kind of stuff. He becomes more obsessed with, obviously, buying all these cars and all these possessions. I know we had these before when he was the emperor.
Yeah.
But do you think there is any suggestion that there is a negative influence from the West?
I think so, absolutely. You get a very strong impression, I think, that this is a mixed-up world. It's bizarre. It doesn't fit. It's a square peg in a round hole, whatever other cliches I can come up with in the next 2 minutes. You know, and it's definitely a feeling that this alien culture is pushing the whole world into something which it shouldn't be going through. It's not
and
very
do,
well
and, do, and do you think there's a fondness for the time in the Forbidden City and what came before?
Well, yes, I think there is to a degree.
And nostalgia. And do you think that, on the whole, that this film, especially from the introduction of Reginald Johnson, because he arrives around the time that the revolution starts to happen, do you think that it is, in general, kind of just a study of, like I suggested, this loss of identity and culture being kind of reduced by influences from the communist East and from the West? So American-influenced Japan is kind of affecting them in one direction, and then the regime is changing, becoming communist in China and taking over. The Maoist regime kind of kicks in, and that's kind of the two forms pulling them all away from their original kind of...
Their roots. Yes, I think to a degree it is about that. It's also about other things. So there's a very strong anti-Japanese strand in it, I would have said. The Japanese are forever the baddies in this, aren't they? And if there is a baddie, it's the Japanese.
And is that logical if Bertolucci is on the left and it is China approved?
Yes, absolutely. This is kind of, this is China outwards. And indeed, you know, so they show images of the rape of Nanking, with actually some really brutal original footage, that suddenly hits you and you say, well, hang on, where am I now? That the Japanese actually tried to cut out when they showed the film in Japan until Bertolucci objected. So
do you think this is when the movie is starting to push towards a certain amount of propaganda?
Yeah, I would suspect absolutely that the Chinese, whether they said anything or not, nobody ever suggested they did, but they would absolutely have looked at that and said, this is what we want to be saying about that period of history.
Because it's really interesting when you use documentary footage in a cinema, in a movie. They do it in Black Klansman as well, which is out at the moment.
Right.
Those are always really powerful political moments.
And it really hits you in the movie because you're suddenly taken out of this golden, highly painted world into stark, brutal, black and white
And images. Then, when you're shown that, combined with the compassion provided by the prison leader,
yeah,
you start to suddenly see the prison system in a slightly new light. And the suggestion is, perhaps, that he was wrong to join up with the Japanese.
Yeah.
And it gives credence to the general kind of Maoist regime.
Yes, I totally agree that there is a subtle message in there. But then, you know, how much would you argue with the idea that the Japanese regime in Manchuria was a bad thing?
Yes. The only reason I think it's worth talking about is because when we've talked about kind of the viewpoint, we've looked at the viewpoint from the West, but we've acknowledged when you're questioning the sources of anything, a lot of the sources in this movie are approved by one side of this scenario. So I just think it's...
Yeah.
Even if we fall on the line, we're not sure it's, like, too strong.
Yeah.
It's just worth considering.
Absolutely. I totally agree that it could not be unaffected by it. And Bertolucci would have written the movie with that in mind. I want to get this movie done. And he would absolutely, I am sure, have said, right, I'm going to try and walk this line. But it could have been worse, is all I would say.
And he is a little bit negative and critical of quite a lot of the stuff that's happening, of the emperor himself, of both regimes. Mm. So it's not like a
and again, you see the prison governor, you know, go through the Cultural Revolution and he's sort of brought down. Okay, so in terms of historical accuracy, a lot of it is well researched. You know, it follows a sensible and accurate framework. Some of the colour in the film in terms of the eunuchs, what they do, what the world would have been like. The fact they carry their genitalia in boxes, for example, is true. It takes you through the prison regime, knocking off, I suspect, some of the violence or some of the aggression in the process. But it takes you through the process. As we said, it doesn't shy away from some horrors, but generally speaking, they're not Chinese horrors, they're Japanese horrors. Puyi comes out a bit better than he might have done. So
yes.
There are a couple of quotes I picked up. So he writes, "By the age of 11, flogging a eunuch was part of my daily regime." And you don't see that. And I wonder why. You could have shown that. He, in terms of his relationship with with the women in his life, he writes, "Frankly, I knew nothing about love. In other marriages, husband and wife were equal, but to me, wife and consort were both slaves and tool of their master." Actually, some of that comes across, but they knock the edge off his brutality again, because I suspect Bertolucci says, okay, he's not a particularly attractive character, I can't make him very attractive, but I'm not going to hit them with the full force, and otherwise I'll lose my audience.
There's the scene where he's in prison and he makes that other man put the toothpaste powder on his toothbrush. And you can kind of view it a couple of ways. You could look at it as, it's like you have to feel kind of sad for him because he's out of touch with the world and he's lost. And he says, my whole family's gone. And like he's been brought up one way. He doesn't know how to live in the new world. Or it's easy to see him as this kind of entitled, selfish, arrogant character who continues to abuse others around him.
Yes, and doesn't really make a genuine effort until right at the end of the film to adapt. Although right at the end of the film, he kind of does adapt. So you see him, as we've said, he becomes a gardener. He's become an observer, but not an emotionless observer. So you kind of feel as though maybe he has finally crossed that bridge.
Yes.
And learnt that he is not this entitled person and that he can find something out of life without it revolving around him.
So obviously it gives him this really positive ending. He shares his cricket.
Yeah.
That little boy. Whether he's there or not is weird because he kind of seems like a ghost.
Yeah, he then disappears
afterwards. And he tries to obviously save the prison master. So he's trying to do these good deeds at the end. And like you say, if they've been pulling punches throughout, then it kind of makes it easier to kind of accept that. But I don't connect with him that much.
No, nor do I.
Did you think in that scene, in the march, that there was going to be more violence at the end of that scene?
Yes.
With him either being physically assaulted a lot.
Indeed.
Or the actual... The prison guy being killed.
Yeah, I think that was one of the places where I think they knocked the edges off what might have happened.
Yes.
Okay, we should draw it to a close. Anything else you want to bring up, or should we go to the all-important final two questions, which are the scoring, and why would I suggest anybody goes to see this movie?
I have nothing else to add.
Nothing more to add.
Nope.
Great. So let's do the marking first. Quality as a film, Wolf, what would you go for? What would you go for?
Probably 6 or 7.
6 or 7. I think 6 or 7. 6 or 7. I think I'm moving towards 6.
Okay. I do think that I can understand why it won all the awards for cinematography, score, editing, lighting, etc. All of that technically is phenomenal. The scenes look brilliant. I have a little less faith in the direction. And the more we've talked about it, the more it actually does feel quite influenced.
Actually, you've managed to bring out
the more
the
we've
dodgier.
Talked about all those little moments, it increasingly feels...
It's felt dodgier and dodgier.
More influenced
yes,
by
I feel more. I feel as I ought to be putting the DVD box in a brown paper bag and putting it on the top shelf now.
My main surprise was it won 9 Oscars and it was hailed and I could only find really good reviews to start with. So I thought... And because the history was intriguing, I thought it would be fascinating. It really just didn't grab me enough.
I liked it with my head, not my heart, as it were.
Yeah.
Okay, so we go for 6?
Sure, yeah, okay. 6.
Historical accuracy.
I'm going to guess it's a decent rating. Are you going to say maybe an 8?
I think you should mark for yourself.
But
I'll tell you whether you're on the right.
You've done more of the research. Okay.
True. I was going to give 7.
Yeah, and I was going to say, thinking about it, because we question some of its motives, if it's being affected by any political leaning, both from the director, who we know to be very political, and by a regime that is very political, of which they might align with each other,
you've got to reduce it a little bit.
But obviously, it's all accounted for generally through his autobiography and through...
Basic framework is right. He's done some messing about, and his interpretation is a particular way, and he's added in some sex that didn't happen... But, you know, the framework is...
Yeah, it's a 7, probably. It's really just his agenda that is questionable.
Indeed.
And that kind of feeds into every little scene, how he adjusts little stuff.
Yeah.
But most of what happened kind of did happen.
Okay, that's fantastic. So why would I recommend anybody to go to see this film? I'd recommend them for the spectacle. The spectacle alone is wonderful. I'd recommend it for somebody who wants to be led into the subject of 20th century Chinese history.
The footage inside the Forbidden City is incredible.
It's amazing, yeah.
It really is. I would recommend you see it in the best quality version you can see it as well.
Yeah.
There's
indeed.
A high-quality Blu-ray out there.
Yeah.
My gosh, get
yes,
it.
Yes, that is true. And we can promise you that after 3 hours, the film does at least give you a bit of closure. So, you know, you get something at the end. Thank you very much, Wolf. I enjoyed it. Oh, hang on, we can't go yet. Because we have to have my roundup from...
Woody's Roundup.
Woody's Roundup. He's the rootin' stootin' sheriff in the wild, wild west. We have to have Woody's Roundup. We should call it Woody's Roundup from now, even though it wouldn't be Woody if he's not here.
Well, anyway. we could get Woody to come in
Woody.
And do it.
Or we could have William the Marshal.
I'll just call Tom Hanks.
We've got William the Marshal here. We could have Woody's Roundup. He's the rootin' stootin' night marshal in the... Anyway, shall we get on with it?
Yes.
This is A Bridge Too Far. I was very conscious when we did A Bridge Too Far that we were, at last, hitting that big red nerd button. Maybe that's the wrong word, but you know, if there was ever a film that was for the real enthusiast of military history, this, or maybe The Longest Day, has got to be it. Everything down to the finest detail. And I have to say that as soon as the comments started flowing in, my expectations and prejudices were confirmed. Casual and totally authoritative references to two-para, the use of the words deployment or the fillet's pocket, I immediately felt inadequate. I must say that I was surprised at the lack of a large collective groan. I really thought we'd have a split between the lovers and haters of war films, but unless people just stayed away, we didn't really see that. 60% of you loved it, only 3% hated it, and not that many declared they'd rather stick their heads in a toilet rather than see it at all, which is a good thing for janitors everywhere. A bit more expected was that for 9 of you, it's in the top film of all time section. If you love war films, you love them big time, I suspect. Richard made the point that the film's pretty influential. Here we are, one of the Allies' failures, and yet it's really well known, supporting the view that we need to take historical accuracy seriously, well, that's what I concluded anyway. And while mostly the discussion was about what a cock-up the whole thing was, before we get into that, there was a strand of the discussion from folks such as Nathan, Neil, Richard, that said, look, hindsight's a wonderful thing. Thinking the Germans were beaten was not a completely daft proposition. But essentially, Alan, Richard, Dave, others had a good old Barney about whether or not the film gave proper coverage of whether it was doomed or not. There were family reminiscences and personal connections, which is one of the wonderful things about doing films on recent history, and it was great to see people's trips as well, including a bit of video conversation in Holland, which was wonderful. But my personal favourite has got to be Paul's gag. We'd been talking about length. The word bloat came up more than was comfortable, I have to say. Paul said he'd read a cut-down version of the book, but couldn't really understand the film on the basis of it. Maybe because the book had been abridged too far. How good is that? Okay, I hope I was brilliant and abridged too far. I don't know, because I've recorded this before I did that. So, thank you very much, everybody. Thanks for listening. Do come along and join us at Facebook. Tell us what you think. Have a vote. And we'll see you next time.
Yes, thank you very much.
Perfect.
Are you not entertained?